This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In a 4-3 decision last week, Supreme Court justices voted to reject Abigail Fisher's challenge to the University of Texas's approach on student admissions. Fisher, a white student, held that she was denied acceptance based on her race and challenged the school's affirmative action program to encourage a diverse student body. UT considers a number of factors, including race, when accepting students. Justice Elena Kagan recused herself from the vote, leaving Justice Anthony Kennedy to issue the swing vote. Kennedy has never before voted in favor of race-based admissions. Supporters of affirmative action are celebrating the decision. My guest is Ethan Lloyd. He's a law fellow at the Haas Institute for a Fair and Inclusive Society at UC Berkeley. Welcome to the program, Ethan.
Thank you for having me.
Now, how much of this vote, you think, turned out the way it did because Texas's program isn't actually a traditional affirmative action program? It only factors in race as one of many factors, so it's what people might call a race-conscious approach to admission, which is why the Supreme Court ended up favoring it rather than something that would very clearly and directly try to have, you know, quotas for certain racial groups.
Well, you know, I think that's what it really focuses on. That's what it really hinges on, is the fact that it was racially conscious and the fact that it didn't really use a hard racial factor as a component in the test. Now, if we look to Gratz, which was a previous Supreme Court case that failed, the Supreme Court specifically noted that the use of quotas in racial admissions is not permissible. So the fact that Fisher too used race as a soft factor is what really hinged, what really succeeded.
So explain why the court actually was even hearing this case again, because it had heard it once before, right?
Right. So the case is a very, very nuanced, it's a very nuanced subject, I would say. In the past, we've had Grutter, which established that diversity in higher education is a compelling interest so long as it's narrowly tailored to accomplish its goal. And Fisher 1 was essentially a challenge to that. And the country was, you know, really waiting to see what happened. However, the court really sent it back down to the Court of Appeals to see what would happen, and not necessarily see what would happen, but to let them deal with the issue. But however, the court agreed to grant it again, and here we are. And thankfully, the court found in our favor this time around.
And of course, it might have been a very different decision if Antonin Scalia had been alive. Anthony Kennedy's vote was the big surprise. And I'm wondering whether, you know, I don't know if this is speculation, but has he sort of evolved on his position on using race as a factor in admissions?
Well, you know, that's the big thing. That's the big question, because never before, as you said earlier, never before has he sided on the issue of affirmative action to this degree. And if you read the opinion, he is very, very, very staunchly on the support of affirmative action. He even says defer to the universities, which is something that we've never seen before with Justice Kennedy. Now, many people are trying to speculate how this happened or what has changed with him, but you know, I can say for myself, I'm very happy to see that to see his change of evolution.
Yeah,
exactly.
So, Ethan, let's step back for those who just have not really been following the story from the beginning. This is a long-running case. Tell us,
very long.
Yeah, can you explain like what it was that Abigail Fisher contended in the first place? Why she brought this lawsuit to begin with, especially given that study after study has shown the greatest beneficiaries of affirmative action programs have been white women, women like Abigail Fisher. Did she have, as far as you can tell, a strong case to say that her race kept her from fairly being admitted into UT?
In my opinion, I would have to say no. Now, for some history to the to the admissions plans that the University of Texas has. There's the top 10% plan, the Texas top 10% plan, and there's also the holistic admissions plan. Now, the Texas top 10% plan admits students from the top 10% of each high school in Texas. Well, now with that case,
no questions asked, right? It's like straight up, if you're in the top 10% of your high school, you have an admission into UT.
Exactly, exactly. No questions asked. If you're in the top 10%, you get an admission to UT. However, Abigail Fisher was not in the top 10% of her plan, of her high school, so there's no reason to believe for her to believe that she will be admitted through that program. And the thing is, that program is also racially neutral because Texas is highly segregated and a lot of the high schools are highly segregated. So what that does is it produces a diverse class through the means of the segregation. So you have the top 10% from one high school that's majority white, and you have the top 10% from another high school that's majority black, which will create a racially diverse program, admissions class. Now, for the holistic admissions program, that plan is more, I wouldn't say as strict and cut off as the Texas top 10% plan. That relies on more soft factors to determine whether or not a candidate would be a suitable match for the University of Texas. Now, one of those factors that it does use is race, and I think that's what Abigail Fisher was trying to attack. Hmm. However, she just, I don't mean to come for her or anything, but her application just wasn't up to par for the university, and I think she was upset about that and decided to pursue legal action, which, as we now see, didn't work out very well.
I mean, she wasn't a straight A student, right? Let's just
come
out and say that she was not maybe an average student or maybe even below average. Not, I haven't seen the particulars of her grade or the details of her applications, but definitely it wasn't like she was an exceptional student who really should have gotten in, but didn't. Let's talk about how important it is to have a diverse student body. And this seems to be, it's possible it might have been what swayed Anthony Kennedy, this idea that really benefits nobody to have monochromatic campuses, right?
Right, and I can speak to that myself. You know, I graduated recently from Howard University in Washington, D.C., and now I'm here at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law, and I've now noticed the differences in having a more diverse student body. Howard was very, very diverse, and when I come to Berkeley, it is still diverse, but you know, there aren't as many black students at Berkeley as there were with Howard, and I feel that some students can perform better with more black students, or you know, with more students of that they can associate with, or just naturally associate with. Mm-hmm. Now,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
Now, with diversity, you know, you have California Proposition 209, that really did a number on admissions for black students and other students in California. However, this case is very, very good because it really re-energizes other universities who are trying to look for racially neutral programs or who are trying to look for racially conscious programs to promote a more diverse student body.
Right. I'm glad you brought up 209. So in 1996, California voters passed Proposition 209 that straight up banned the use of race and factoring race in admissions on California campuses. And schools in the state have struggled to achieve diverse student bodies. Now, could this decision be used by schools to return to using race as a factor, or would it have to be the state legislature that changed it or even sent it back to voters?
So it would have to be the state legislature. So this is more of a state issue. However, as I said earlier, this decision, if it doesn't do anything for states in particular or for California Proposition 209, it re-energizes schools. It re-energizes universities. So it gives universities, you know, that new fresh alternative, that new fresh take. All right, what can we do to really get a diverse student body? Because we see how important this is. We know the effects of it, so we need to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And now that the Supreme Court is recognizing this, hopefully it's only going to go up from here. You know, I like to view this as, you know, a wiping of the slate, and essentially just a new direction, hopefully in the right direction. We have a very bright day in our future.
Now, what's really interesting, of course, is that when we look at race and racially diverse campuses, a lot of people contend that Asian Americans are overrepresented on campuses. Harvard University apparently seems to think so. There's a lawsuit by a number of Asian American groups that claim that Harvard is actually restricting Asian Americans through its admissions process because it might think that there are just too many Asians on campus. And apparently this is a sort of historic thing that had been used to restrict the number of Jewish American students on Harvard's campuses. It's strange that college campuses never feel that there are just too many white students on campus.
Right. Well,
I mean, could the Supreme Court decision be used as a way to sort of, back Harvard on its position or undermine Harvard? I mean, if you were to truly say all decisions should be race neutral, you might end up with a school that has far more Asian Americans proportionate to their race and far fewer Black and Latino students proportionate to that, and even really fewer white students proportionate to it.
Well, I can't really speak for Harvard in particular, but in the Supreme Court case, the opinion, there was an amicus brief that was cited that actually supported quite different evidence from the common belief. Now, this cites that Asian American students do actually benefit from affirmative action, if I read the amicus brief correctly. So these statistics are of much contention right now, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing what happens with it. Mm-hmm. However, as far as racially neutral is concerned, I tend to lean on the fact that, yes, it might end up with a larger Asian student population because it is racially neutral. So we'll see what happens, but just looking at the way things have been going and looking at back at history and just, the population of schools, it is possibly fair to say that.
Now, I'm wondering, Ethan, when you hear terms such as race neutral, colorblind, etc., these are often terms that are used by conservatives to undermine affirmative action programs, to undermine the righting of historical wrongs. And how does that play out to you as a Black student on a campus? How does that, given the history of our country, given that the Supreme Court had to decide on Brown versus Board of Education to desegregate high schools and public schools, these notions of race neutral and colorblind keep rearing their heads.
Right. And to speak to that as a Black student and now in a majority white institution, I think it does hurt us when you use terms like racially neutral, when you use terms like colorblind. That is, in my opinion, not acknowledging the important benefits that diversity has to offer to a student body. There have been studies that have shown when students are exposed to a more diverse student body, they perform better in diverse workplaces, and that's actually what the Supreme Court has relied upon in this decision. So to say colorblind admissions programs are the way to go, I would have to say that's false. I mean, we've seen evidence. We have evidence of how this works completely well and completely to the benefit of everyone when you have a diverse student body.
Well, Ethan, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck to you with the rest of your education.
Thank you. I very much appreciate it.
Ethan Lloyd is a law fellow at the Haas Institute for a Fair and Inclusive Society at the University of California, Berkeley. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.